Jezus voor. En drie jaar zo voor de stress en voor. Those who teach it, that we might learn more about those who are lost and need our help, and pray that we would be able to answer their questions and give answer for those who need answers to their problems and to their faithfulness. Pray, Father, for Gary and those who teach the classes tonight. Pray for all members here that cannot be edified and glorify your name. We're mindful there are others who would like to be here that are unable because of sickness and various other reasons. Pray that you'll be with them, sitting with them, the blessings they need, that they might be able to come back and worship with us from time to time. We are thankful for all the material blessings you give us each day. We realize that all these blessings come from thee. Especially, Father, we are thankful for the spiritual blessings and the edification that we receive from being here and from praying and singing songs, hymns and songs to thee, and pray that you give any unforgiven sins that we might have. Help us always to have wisdom and look for thee in time of help. We know that you will help us. We pray for those who are in difficult places, for those who are spreading the gospel abroad, and they'll be successful. People will see their needs and be able to look to them and be able to call you their Father. Pray that we'll always be able to call you our Father, and that you can call us your children. Pray now that you'll be with us as we enter into this lesson, and help us always to help us always to be ready to give an answer for the things that we need to do. Pray that you continue with us in this class and help us as we stand in Jesus' name.
Amen.
Thank you. All right. As Trevor mentioned, when he asked me what I wanted to try and do, I actually volunteered for this because I was interested in learning more about it. And one thing I can say, I know a little bit more about it than we agreed that I was going to do. Has anyone ever had the opportunity to speak and to work with someone who is an Islam, the Muslim? Okay, we've got several here, so I encourage any feedback that you guys may have. I haven't. I've talked to a couple when we were in South Africa, but really not in depth. It was more just one-sided from my standpoint, wanting to learn more about it. That's the fact of the speech. Let me tell you real quick, tonight, the way I want to do this is when I first asked myself, what do I know about the Islamic faith? My answer was that I get everything I know from the evening news. Okay, and in my respect is they all want to blow us up. So what I've learned is that not all of them want to do that. All right, and there are some who do, and we need to be aware of that. But what I did is I went back and I wanted to learn more about the history, especially the time of Muhammad. And so that's what I want to share tonight with you, is really from a historical standpoint how it started and how it spread, And then Sunday we'll really get into looking at verses that make our faith stronger, but also what some of the things you may hear from their standpoint and where they get that in the Quran and some of their other books. Why do we want to study these? Why do we want to study these other faiths of people? We talked briefly about it on Sunday.
So I know how to talk with them.
So we can know how to talk with them. But we also given in the New Testament that we are going to have false prophets out there, right? 2 Peter chapter 2 and verse 1. But there were also false prophets among the people, even as there will be false teachers among you who will secretly bring in destructive heresies, even denying the Lord who brought them, and bring on themselves swift destruction. And so we've got prophecy within the New Testament that tells us we are going to have false prophets out there. So that's one of the focuses that we want to look at from this Islam perspective and what their belief is. First of all, I want to go over a couple of definitions and got this from all this stuff is plagiarized, by the way, okay? And I'm trying to give credit where credit is due. But just a few words that will come out in some of the discussions that we're going to have tonight. Islam actually is an Arabic word meaning submission. And so if you are in Islam, you are submitting to the will of God. The term Muslim, it literally means submitter, okay? One who submits to the will of God. One who professes and practices the faith of Islam. And so when you talk about a Muslim is a follower of Islam. Okay. So now, talking about the spread of Islam, okay, it's now the second largest religion in the world. Between 1 to 1.8 billion people in the world are Muslims. All right, and it's growing at a rate of 2.9% per year, or it's currently growing that, but it increases approximately over 0.5% a year. Now, Christianity is approximately growing at 2.3%, but it is 2.3%, it's not growing. Which tells us that by the year 2025, it will, if it continues on as it is, it will become the largest religion in the world. Okay? So it will affect us in one way or another. I moved it right before I came in. This is the current map of the population of Islam. Of course, we're going to be looking in where it originated from. And this actually is very descriptive of how it spread, because that's where it spread first, and this is continuing to grow there. But as you can see, there are Muslims all over the world, and it is continuing to grow. All right. Allah is the word for deity, and it's formed by the Arabic Allah, which means literally the God. In their belief is the eternal and uncreated creator of the universe and of all mankind. We're going to speak a little bit more about that term because it's got an interesting origin. Okay. Of course, Muhammad, and that's his full name, I'm not going to try to do that, is the professed prophet in Islam, and his faith's most important and significant messenger. What's interesting in the books that I've read is, in the same book, it was a Muslim author, and he says, you know, we can't call them Mohammedites or Mohammedism or anything like that, because that's offensive, because it tells them that you think that they were followers of Muhammad, where they're followers of Allah. Okay? And they see Muhammad as the greatest prophet. And then later on in the book, it talks about those who follow the prophet Muhammad. So he kind of contradicted himself within his same book. And you will find that they say they don't follow him, but it is strongly, strongly, everything that they talk about, Muhammad is brought up in there. Right. The Quran, it's spelled with a K, K-O-R-N in English. It means literally the recitation or the reading. All right. This is Islam's holiest book, being the uncreated word of God revealed through Gabriel to the prophet Muhammad. And it consists of 114 chapters called a surah, arranged not in any chronological order at all. All right, this range from the longest surah comes first. You're jumping back and forth a lot on particular verses on certain situations. Hadith is a word with several meanings, but it's really the recording sayings and doings of the Prophet Muhammad. So apparently while he was alive and he would be getting these revelations, he also made his own comments, and those were supposedly recorded. And is not as sacred as the Quran, but it's looked upon as law. And then the Sunnah is the practices of the prophets. And so what they would do is the people who were companions of the prophet, when a situation arose, they would take a look at how he handled that. Some of that got written down. And so really the three books, so to speak, that they reference is the Quran first, the Hadith, and then the Sunnah. And that's kind of where they get their doctrinal beliefs from. All right, now we're going to go into really the history. This is in the 6th century, and there was at the time the world powers were the, I'm going to mess up with some of these words, so you guys just bear with me. The Byzantine, which is where the Roman emperor moved the headquarters from Rome, Constantinople, which is today Istanbul, Turkey. Okay. Of course, this is the Arab Peninsula where we're going to be talking about. But to their northwest, they had basically the Roman Empire, and then over here they had the Persian Empire. And at the time, there was trade coming over from India going back into the Europe, but they didn't want to go through there because the Persians and the Romans were always fighting each other. So where would they cut across? Well, they would cut across the Arabian Peninsula. And either going west to east and north to south, there were crossroads. We'll just make that. In a town called Mecca. All right? And the trade was very important to that town. It was built around trade. And this is where Muhammad was actually born. The tribe that he belonged to was the Quraysh tribe. And I mentioned tribes in these pictures. These are some of the tribes that existed there. From an Arab standpoint, the tribe is the most important thing. You're born into a tribe, so therefore you are a member of that tribe. And you are protected. If someone does you harm, the Arab rule was that they will return that. Also, there were smaller tribes on the Arab Peninsula that really couldn't have their own power. So what they would do is they would go to a larger tribe and they would pay some sort of a tax and they would come under the umbrella of this larger tribe. And so therefore, they were recognized, although they didn't have blood connections, they were recognized as a member of that tribe. So if another tribe attacked them, then this larger umbrella tribe would then take vendetta on the other tribe that attacked them. So that's very important because we're going to talk about that in Muhammad's belief systems and everything. So just wanted to bring that up, what the situation was in that time. He was an orphan. Muhammad was an orphan. He was brought up by his uncle. He worked some of the caravans, but he grew up as a sheep herder. When he was around 20 years old, he went to work for a wealthy widow who was running caravans up to the north. And he successfully was able to bring the caravans back and forth. And he was actually known as a very honest person. He was known around Mecca as an honest person. And she saw in him something. And she decided to marry him. He was 25. She was 40. She was very, very wealthy. So all of a sudden, now Muhammad had opportunity to work on more caravans and do all that, which is important because he wasn't stuck in Mecca all of his life. What you're going to hear from a lot of the Islams is, yes, he was uneducated and he was illiterate. He could read Arabic. But some of the books that I've read really use that as an instance because how can an uneducated man talk like this and have these sayings? Well, one reason is because he didn't stay in Mecca. He was traveling all around. The other interesting thing is a lot of his philosophies we're going to see is brought in from the Jewish beliefs and the Christian beliefs. The Muslim written book that I read made the statement that there were no Jews and everything in there. We're going to see in just a minute that that's a false statement. Okay. He was born around 570. Now I left on purpose. I left off the AD. When you read a lot of this, remember these are not my thoughts. Okay. So some of this, you know, when I capitalize the prophet and all that, I am basically typing. Okay. And then in 610 is when really his the system that he held started. Right? One of the other things I want to bring out, the religion at the time, very important. They were very, very paganistic. At the time in Mecca, there was a building called the Kaaba. Right? I've actually got this is a current picture of it, okay? Actually, the Hajj, we'll talk about in just a minute, is actually going on right now, and we'll talk about that. But this building is one of the most, if it is probably the most important religious building in the Islam faith, all right? Their belief is that this was originally built by Adam. It was rebuilt by Abraham and Ishmael after Abraham was willing to offer Ishmael. All right. This was rebuilt, and at the time, the pagans had 365 idols in there, and every year they would have a pilgrimage or a Hajj to this. And I'm not going to get into a lot of detail. I've got that later on about what the pilgrimage actually does. Very ritualistic. Okay. It also has a black stone in one of the corners. And they believe that this is actually goes back to Adam's period too. And it's a symbol from the heavens. Everyone assumes that it's a meteorite. Apparently it's never been studied. It's been broken several times from attacking tribes and everything. It's held together by something right now. Southeastern corner. Now, when they go to the Hajj, one of the things they have to do is they have to touch and they have to kiss this rock. Okay? Well, that rock was there prior to Muhammad. Okay? So we have these are certain things that we have to remember because moving forward, the Muslims look back to Muhammad, but what he's going to do is he's going to incorporate a lot of the things that the Arabs were already doing at the time. Okay? Very important to remember. All right, so you've got 365 idols and you have people coming into town every year. What are those people going to be buying? Little idols. Okay? Now, Muhammad his ideas were going more and more toward a monotheism, the worship of one God. Actually, the whole history tells us that because of the influx of the Europeans and everything, the Arabs were even starting to think about changing to that belief system. Right? So he wasn't the first one. Well, he started preaching that when he started getting his revelations. Actually, it was 2 years after he got his first revelation that he started teaching, because his wife had to convince him that he was a prophet of God. Right? And I'm not saying these things to make fun of these people. I was talking to Trevor on Sunday. I said, you know, the more I read, I have to respect their faith. I totally disagree with it, okay? But I have to respect it. So when I'm saying these things, I'm not saying, you know, I'm not making fun of them. I'm just trying to tell you what I've learned since I've been studying about this. But they were very materialistic with the trade and with this idol worship and everything. Of course, there were people making a lot of money. And so when Muhammad comes in there and he starts preaching about, we can't do this, we need to worship one God, how do you think those people took it? It's the same way they took it when Peter and them says, you can't do this. You know? Well, that's going to affect my livelihood. And it causes big uproar. The same thing happened in Mecca. And guess what they wanted to do to Muhammad? They wanted to kill him. All right. There was a little town up here about 280 kilometers away called Yathrib. And they were having some big time troubles. They had multiple tribes coming in there. They were having all the time conflicts and everything. And Muhammad had built about 70 converts by this time. The Meccans were, they just wanted to get rid of him. And they actually invited him up there to actually come in and basically rule over their city. Prior to him leaving, the Meccans decided that they're going to take care of the problems. And they hire one person from all of the tribes within their vicinity, within Arabia, and they're going to go in and they're going to assassinate Muhammad. Why did they choose one from each tribe?
No retribution.
Okay. Who are you going to avenge? Who are you going to go back and kill? Because every tribe was represented. Someone came in and told Muhammad of this. Him and his best friend at the time, Abu Bakr, and we'll talk about him a little bit later. They flee and they make Haraj, the migration. Okay, and they move from Mecca to Yathrib. And Yathrib becomes the city of the prophet. Or it's literally the city. And I'm going to call it Medina. I started calling it Medina. I don't know how it's working. So I think I've got it in my brain now to call it Medina. Alright, so Muhammad and his 70 followers move up and they rename the city. And he builds his first mosque there. All of a sudden, he starts preaching, and these people start converting to Islam, and the city actually becomes calm. But, and they start bringing in new converts. All of a sudden, remember, there is no agriculture here. If they need something, they steal it. They go and steal it from another tribe. Well, what Muhammad was preaching was that the community is more important than the tribe. And what has been revealed to him from God is that you don't need to take out this retribution because you don't need to be doing anything to someone else. He had some very good ideas. As he grew up an orphan and hungry, he was very concerned with how the rich were treating the poor. And one of his ideals or one of his revelations was that you shouldn't hoard money. If you have money, you should be willing to give it to those who don't. You should be willing to help out your fellow man. You can't attack them. And so this idea grew, and all of a sudden, the tribe is now lower on the list than what the ummah, the community, is. And if you look down at 620, when he makes his move up to Medina, the bullet point, social justice was a crucial virtue of Islam. Muslims were commanded as their first duty to build a community characterized by practical compassion in which there was fair distribution of wealth. This was far more important than any doctrinal teaching about God. I'm going to read that again. This was far more important than any doctrinal teaching about God. The political and social welfare of the ummah or community would have sacramental value for Muslims. If the ummah prospered, it was a sign that Muslims were living according to God's will. Right? So all of a sudden, the community is the most important thing. More and more people start converting. All of a sudden, they have trouble feeding everyone. It's the month of Ramadan. You can't attack any other tribe in the month of Ramadan. Muhammad finds out that there's a huge caravan coming from the north to Mecca. And he decides he's going to attack it. He goes out and attacks it. Some of his followers goes, but what about the requirements of Ramadan? He then has a revelation that it's okay to attack the infidels. okay? A lot of times, what you're going to see is situations occur, he makes a decision, later on, he gets a revelation from God that his decision is correct. Okay? Convenience. Mm-hmm. All right? Well, all of a sudden, Mecca's caravan is no longer there. What do you think they're going to do? They're going to go and attack them. Well, they send in representatives from multiple tribes, and anyone that has any military background is, when you get a group of people together and you've got multiple leaders and you start attacking someone, there's going to be some chaos. Well, Muhammad found out about it, and the Meccan force was a lot larger than the force that he brought up, but he told them exactly what to do, and him being the leader, they did what they did, and guess who won? The Muslims won. And guess what they said? It must be a sign from God, because we won, that what we are doing is correct. All right, that was called, I've got all of this in my notes. They've named battles for all of these things. Turn over to page 2 on the back. This is one thing I wanted to bring out. Within Medina itself, we talked about how some of the Muslim book that I read said that there were no Jews or anything around there. Actually, there were 4 clans of Jewish tribes in Medina. All right? And guess what Muhammad did when he moved to Medina? What do you think, from the Islamic standpoint, that Muhammad would do? When he moved to Medina, there were 4 Jewish tribes. Okay? From the Islamic standpoint, what would you think that Muhammad would do with those Jews?
Embrace
them. Well, but from today's standpoint, I would have thought he was going to get rid of them, right? But he didn't. He didn't coerce them into converting to Islam. If you look at the 4th bullet point, the Quran says strongly that there shall be no coercion in matters of faith. And that's in Surah 2, verse 256. And commands Muslims to respect the beliefs of Jews and Christians. Actually, and they're referenced in the Quran. Okay, they're called that word in Arabic. A phrase usually translated people of the book, but is more accurately rendered people of an earlier revelation. Okay? He respected their belief. We're going to find out in a minute what they think about the Torah and the Bible. Okay? But what's important, I think, from my standpoint, was that Muhammad was not forcing them to convert to Islam. And on Sunday, we'll probably talk about some of the current aspects of the Islamic situation. Also, he talks about in the first bullet point in the Quran that there were lots of prophets. Actually, later on in your notes, Muhammad is quoted as saying there was 124,000 prophets sent down from God. At the time, they had the true revelation of God. What they believe, and I'll just go ahead and tell you, what they believe is that the Torah and the Bible, all these other books that these other religions have been either lost multiple times, mistranslated numerous times, and that they are no longer the representation of God. So therefore, God came down and gave His final and true revelation to Muhammad, which made all of those, basically all of those other books obsolete. Right? So that's the way they look at it, from the Quran to the other books. But I think it's important to see what Muhammad's philosophy was about the Jews and the Christians at the time. He was not out to, although a little bit later he does exterminate some, but that wasn't his focus. All right? Now, about 624, that's when this first battle happens. And this was an important time. When they went into the mosque, originally they prayed 3 times a day, and they changed that to 5 times a day, which is still what the Muslims do. Guess where they prayed to?
Jerusalem, initially.
All right. They initially prayed facing toward Jerusalem. In 624, Muhammad suddenly realized, I guess, in conversations with the Jews and the Christians, that there were some conflicts between those two things. And he goes, wait a minute, that's, you know, God, he doesn't think that there should be conflicts. And he was in the mosque one day, and they were praying, and he stood up, and he told them to turn and face toward Mecca and pray. That was the change. They've actually got the date. It was January something that he actually did that. All right. So that was a turning point for the Islamic faith. And what some of the historians say is he was basically turning his back on the beliefs of the Jews and the Christians, and going back to the original monotheistic faith of Abraham. Remember the Kaaba we talked about? What did they believe? What did the Arabics believe at the time? That it was built by Abraham. Okay, so now they face toward that shrine that they've made, and they pray five times a day. In the next year, we see that there's still some battles going on. I mean, all these people are starting to convert toward Islam. They want to get rid of this guy. The authorities want to get rid of this guy. And so they go in and they have another battle, but they're defeated at this time. All right? And guess what happens? Guess who gets blamed? Two of the Jewish clans or tribes get blamed for collaborating with the Meccans, and they get expelled from the city. All right? In 2 years, they have another battle. They are given fair warning that the Meccans are bringing this huge force, and one of his advisors tells them to dig a big trench in front of the city. I couldn't find any description of how big it was, but it basically negligated the cavalry that the Meccans had. And the Muslims soundly defeated the Meccans. And they call that actually the Battle of the Trench, which makes sense. In 628, guess what Muhammad decides he's going to do? What were the Arabs doing every year? They were making the Hajj, the pilgrimage. And so he decides he's going to make the pilgrimage. He's going to make the Hajj. And his followers are going, Muhammad, you know what they're going to do. And so he sets out with, I think, 1,000 of his followers. And there's apparently a safe zone around Mecca somewhere. And his plan was to make it to that safe zone. And the Meccan army found out about it, and they sent out assassins, but they couldn't find him until he made it to the safe zone. Well, there he is, and so they allow him to come in and to do the pilgrimage. Well, some of the Meccan leaders start converting to Islam. Well, that really makes sense. Well, he goes back to Medina. And they actually make a peace treaty with him. And that allows him to go into Mecca and everything like that. And 630, 2 years later, some Meccan forces go in and attack some of the Muslim tribes. They basically break the treaty. Muhammad gathers a force of about 40,000, I believe is what they said. And he marched into Mecca and he encamped around it. Now, it was less than that because, interesting enough, they encamped around the hills, and he told them to make fires so that it would make it look larger. Interesting enough. Sorry to know about that, too. All right. And so the Meccans said, ooh, look at all this huge force, and they basically opened the doors to Mecca. Muhammad walked in and took over the city without anybody being killed. No bloodshed at all. Okay. The first thing he does, he goes to the Kaaba and he destroys all of the idols. Except for one, which we'll talk about. They don't recognize that as an idol, but for one. Okay, in 632, Muhammad dies and he is buried in the Medina, and they built a mosque at where his burial place is. Then what happens? The leader of the community, the Ummah, is gone. And typically what happens when the leader dies? chaos starts breaking out.
Well, it did.
There was a reason. There were four men who were very close companions to him. And they, basically how the community and the tribal, going back to the Arab standpoint, how it worked is when the leader died, the most spiritual, strong individual would be elected as the leader. And that's what they did. They went to themselves and they elected Abu Bakr, who was his father-in-law by this time. He had married his daughter, who was either 6 years old or 9 years old, depending on which book you read, when he was 56 years old. Okay? So by this time, Abu Bakr is his father-in-law, and he is elected as caliph. If you look down in 632, it's basically a successor to Muhammad, who is head of the Islamic community. Well, but what happens? Chaos, civil war breaks out. Abu Bakr is able to subdue this revolt. It's actually given a name, the Wars of Ridda, which is basically like a civil war. And he serves 2 years. He dies. Then this Umar, in 634, becomes the second caliph. And this is when the expansion started. By 634, most of the peninsula of Arab was converted to Islam and the community, the Ummah. Well, what does that say? What do we talk about? What is one of the rules of the community and the Ummah? When they needed something, where were they going to get it? They can't attack the other tribes because they're part of the Ummah now. Okay? And so they make the decision, we will now attack non-Muslim communities. And they start, let's see, I've got to, they start expanding. Okay? Let me get rid of that. Okay? And so what they do is, they would go out and they would capture a city. What was the purpose? What is, most of the time, from a military standpoint or a invasion standpoint, what do the soldiers want? The spoils of war. That was the reason that they started expanding and going into these other places. What they didn't do is they didn't make them convert to Islam. Why didn't they make them convert to Islam? Because the Quran says you can't coerce people into converting to Islam. But what they did, they built garrison towns around here where the Muslim soldiers would actually live separate from the community. All right? The community would then pay taxes, but they were then allowed to worship whatever they were worshiping prior to their invasion. What happens? You remember the situation they were in? Most of these were either under the Persian rule or the Roman rule. All of a sudden, they see these garrison towns pop up, and they see how these people are acting. They see that they're distributing their wealth amongst themselves. You know, not no one has need. And guess what happens? The people start looking at this and start saying, "I want to be like that." They start converting to Islam. Now, the people, the soldiers that were there were preaching, but that wasn't the focus. That wasn't the purpose of the expansion. The purpose of the expansion was they didn't have enough food to feed their own people. And so they had to start invading to get that. Now, and in 638, the expansion moves over here, and guess what city they conquer?
Jerusalem.
All right, 638, the Muslims conquered Jerusalem. By 641, they moved up into Syria, Palestine. They moved over east into Egypt. They're starting to control this amount of land here. What happened, like even with the Roman Empire, when they started expanding, when the Islam started expanding, you know, back here in Medina, where the leaders were, what's going to happen to these people way out here? They're going to start losing control. And so they started setting up governors of these areas. All right? And this is the beginning of the fragmentation of the Islamic religion. Okay? And what we're going to see further on, especially after World War I, when a lot of these these states, these countries are built up is really when it just started exploding and we started getting away from the community, especially, and they started making their own little rules and guidelines. And that's what has led us to today in having different aspects between Iran and Iraq. All right? Going back to the caliphs, the fourth caliph was Ali, who was his son-in-law, who actually had the only two grandsons that Muhammad had. And there was a sect that thought that Ali should have been the immediate successor to Muhammad. All right? The Shiite sect. The Shiites. The Sunnis, another sect, go back to basically what Muhammad said and then the community standpoint. So the Shiites and the Sunnis, you still hear about them today, right? That started within 30 years after Muhammad died. All right? We turn over to the next page. We're not going to go into... I put this down because it's a whole lot less than I read. It's some things that you can put in your notebook. You go down to about halfway down where I've got my note. The first four caliphs to succeed Muhammad were all men who had been among his closest companions and had played a leading role in Mecca and Medina. They are known as the Rashidun, or the rightly guided caliphs. Muslims would define themselves in their theology according to the way they assessed the turbulent, glorious, and tragic events of the years. The Islamic political structure began as something akin to a representative democracy. The people would elect the most spiritual Muslim to lead them, but was transformed into a hereditary monarchy by ambitious men 30 years after Muhammad. So it didn't take him too long to start digressing from what his idea of the community was. Right? After the fourth caliph in 661, then you start getting into lots and lots more history, which was really, really interesting reading to me. But I thought this was enough to kind of get you understanding what the situation was in Arab during Muhammad's time. And really, going back to that statement, that to me, this, the community was far more important than any doctrinal teaching about God. Right. And that still holds true today. The Islamic, the sense of community. All right? I tell you what. We're starting to... I'll go over some of the other stuff I've got here. And then we'll look at some of the questions that I've got. What I want you to do when you start looking at these questions is we have to start... You can answer the questions, but what I'm really looking for is for us all to... Where do we find it? Let's just write down the book, chapter, and verse, so to speak. How do we... I think the second question was, how do we know the prophets are from God? Where do we read that? That's something, if we talk to these people, that we're going to need to know. That was kind of my focus of what some of those questions were. Right. I'll bring some more handouts on Sunday with some of the Quranic readings, and we'll compare that to what the Bible has to say. All right. But I really want you to think about that first question. And Trevor already knows the answer. We talked about it on Sunday. But I'm not saying we're going to have all different answers. But I think what we have to understand, and I think when Greg gets up in several weeks and starts talking about the Mormons and where their faith comes from, we have to know who we're talking to. If we're talking to someone from a denomination, people now like to get in that because I'm going to answer my question. Okay? All right, but what we're going to be looking for is some reference material that you can keep into your notebook that if you have an opportunity to talk to these people, hopefully we can begin building this foundation. All right? Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Ooh.
Yeah.
You were telling me what you were doing, but the only thing I didn't do is I
sister, but I'm a Muslim. Born and raised, going to church. She's a Muslim. And the first thing about what they're like, she gave me the best answer anybody ever heard of what Muslims are. She said, there's many kinds of Muslims that there are Christians.
And we'll talk about this Sunday. There's over 300 translations of the Quran.
But that she actually, after 9/11, she was all in her, I mean, she wears the whole bit. She's a redhead with Taylor skin and beans. She wears the whole bit. She was in her front lawn digging plants around her. She was planting things around her mailbox. Somebody called the cops on her. Because she was planting bombs or something, I don't know. But she said she just couldn't believe it because in her mind there are peaceful religions. So,
I
mean, I doubt she would tell you, but Jessica had a suggestion about the seat and the issue. There's less women in the adult ladies class now. And even if you just put some of the benches down up there, if we go to one of those that they fit in, she thought that might help because there's some of the problems with what you have in here.
Right, right.
I watched the lamb have to be humped up on Sunday, and I thought, I can barely walk for some day on so if I was from that, I'm going to have to leave.
Yeah.
So, but some of us just won't fit in pretty little chit.
What can I say? They were here before I was.
Okay. Well, I said that, it's what we got, but she said that, she said, well, there's not been ladies in ladies' class anymore. And I said, that's actually true.
So how do you, I'll let you do that. Shit, the stuff.